Greetings and welcome to the 2021 International Outlook and Opportunity Panel. As a reminder, this call is being recorded today, Tuesday, January 19th, 2021. I'd now like to turn the conference over to Barry Mandenach, Head of Distribution at Virtus Investment Partners. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you, and thanks everybody for joining. Today we have the Virtus first call of 2021, and it's all about the International Outlook and Opportunity. Joined today by three portfolio managers with deep experience in international equity investing. First, Matt Benkendorf, Chief Investment Officer at Vontobel Asset Management. Kishore Rayal, Portfolio Manager and Analyst at Sustainable Growth Advisors, otherwise known as SGA. And Craig Thrasher, Portfolio Manager and Senior Research Analyst at Kayne Anderson Rudnick. Matt, Kishore, and Craig, I welcome and thank you all for joining us today. So what I'd like to do is, 2020 obviously was a memorable year in many ways for the world's equity markets. And we had, a bear market, a bull market, a big recovery, and the global pandemic, and a lot of things in between. And I thought what I'd like to do is really start off the call by asking you about your observations about 2020, your key takeaways, if you will, and your key outlook for 2021. So, Matt, let's start with you, followed by Kishore, and then Craig. If I'd give you each about 5 minutes to go over that, that would be great. Thank you.
Sure. Great. Thanks, Barry. Thanks, everybody, for joining. Let's, in my typical fast-talking fashion, try to cover some ground in 5 minutes here. Let's rewind the clock a little bit, start the context of the start of 2020. Remember about a year ago, we ended 2019 with a rather flourish of its own, right? We entered 2020 at the beginning of this year, 1 year ago, with, little volatility, little concern or risk, acknowledgement more or less. We were staring at an election year largely as to be the most exciting thing of 2020. And the developed markets, even into the end of 2019, us in particular, just to put some context over, we were trimming a bit with a bit of the exaggerated movement that we had in December of 2019. So, we started 2020 with what I would call market complacency and ripeness for an exogenous shock. And now in hindsight, obviously, we got that quite swiftly. In our COVID year, we got our 1-in-100-year global health pandemic. What that did for us is you look back on 2020 in the rearview mirror. While we entered 2020 with a perfectly fine portfolio, happy with what we had, we felt well positioned with good names. The exogenous shock of COVID in 2020, gave us a real quick, great investment opportunity. Despite the catastrophe it's caused globally, it was a very quick, swift investment opportunity if you pounced on it, and which is what we did. We looked across our funds and we took concerted action back in March, April, to sell out of relatively weaker links we had and buy things we've had our eye on for some time, either wholly new position or add to existing positions to get quality up in the portfolio and get underlying growth rate up in the portfolio if we could with an apple-for-apple switch. So, for example, in the emerging markets portfolio, we bought Tencent Music Entertainment, Yandex, Bud APAC, Wind Semi, Asian Paints, names like that. So across, a wide swath of different countries, what we think are all really great businesses in their own right, they got cheap for a very brief window. We think COVID set on then with an upgraded portfolio and accelerated largely existing trends. We think when you look back at 2020, honestly, in our viewpoint, at least at this point, only 1 year later, we look at constructively at, an acceleration of largely a lot of trends that were in place in the world, both positive and negative. Areas of deterioration around certain businesses and industries, it acted to accelerate. In areas it was improving or fortifying around certain industries, it accelerated that. And that's sort of how we've still looked at COVID at this point, just that we look at a longer-term history and feel that human nature is a little bit tougher to change, not saying it won't change, and a lot of these prognostications of massive structural change out of COVID won't happen, but we just personally feel it's a little bit too early to cast judgment on that. If you look at 2022, when we look back, I think the markets had a couple different dynamics at play as well on top of COVID. You had massive further penetration of passive investing, obviously, in the investing landscape, driving a lot of money flows. You had, in the course of pandemic, a lot of pickup in retail and low-cost platform investing flourishing. you know, as we look back now, as even some regulators have noticed some gamification sort of investing going on. And not surprisingly, I think if I look back at market characteristics of 2020 now from our perspective at least, I think the market's become much more momentum driven than anybody wants to realize or really acknowledge. If I look back at this year, you know, 2020 in hindsight, that's how I would characterize it. I think what has told people, Barry, to your point now, shifting a little bit more internationally, is that it's reminded you, even in the U.S., but internationally, you have to stay invested. You know, and 2020 has certainly hopefully been another reminder of that for people. You know, we hit a one-year, 100-year health pandemic. We hit an exogenous shock. And what was the right move? Stay invested. Don't get shaken. Own things you understand and be patient. So I think that's a lot of the story, too, on top of all these shifts going around in 2020. And also, I think it's important as we'll shift to forward-looking here for the last minute, you know, let's not forget and acknowledge the powerful impact of monetary policy that played a substantial role in 2020. It's played a substantial role over the last decade still. And we still continue to sort of see bad news as good news from a monetary policy perspective, and that's certainly putting a big security blanket under asset prices. So that's just part of the reality. You know, you look around the geographic regions, EMEA, I think it's still been a trend back to 2016, a continued recovery trend extending all the way back to the bottom in 2016. We've been continuing to climb out with COVID in between, some businesses breaking down in between, a rise of Chinese inclusion in between, all that. Some narrowness in that market as well, and this later euphoria we've seen more recently. But EMEA has been on this steady path out of the lows from 5 years ago again, which is a good thing. International Europe, you're looking at Europe particularly, you know, it's been a bit of fits and starts. Japan's been, you know, after a period of decades in the wilderness, some reemergence of investment opportunity there, which is good and positive. And UK has been, you know, characterized by the Brexit overhang, but still some great opportunity for great returns in that market if you look through the macro. And names like Flutter in the gaming or gambling space. So I think that's if I look around the world, I think that's how I look at 2020. As I said, monetary policy now as we shift to looking forward is obviously the big elephant. I think people need to acknowledge it's the grease behind the wheels. We have to understand the coming changes as we're seeing it in policy as a result of the election or regardless of the election and fiscal policy and its role to play and what that could mean for inflation clearly. And I think after several years, if you look back over 5 years of compounding and sort of the low to mid-teens rates, depending on the product, it's all about preservation and continued compounding here, but critically, you know, preservation. You know, 6 to 9 months out, we should have very good visibility in COVID being gone from a health perspective, or at least certainly well along its way, and we'll have to see what the economic damage is here. And that's why I say, you know, preserving what we have and have done over this tremendous backdrop of monetary policy help, and decent rates of compounding is the name of the game, being wary of the market dynamics that have changed. And I think that's, you know, being careful of trends that have been very strong that when they break could be very dangerous or treacherously so. So that's kind of very how I'd wrap up looking backwards and a little bit of outlook looking forwards.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for that. Kishore?
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to pick up the baton and really start with the, rather than recap what 2020 and Matt did a great job of that, really focus on the theme of the volatility and incredibly intense volatility for all of us and reiterating, therefore, the importance of staying invested. And one of the keys to that is having a smoother ride approach such that those lows can be tolerated and clients can stay invested and participate in the wealth creation that comes. And that's all the more important because 2020 was a lesson in the unpredictable nature of the human experience and financial markets. And I think 2021 has similar variables at play. Of course, we're all hoping for the vaccine, but we have these more virulent strains that are still out there and, you know, arising in the UK and South Africa and Brazil. And although we're all optimistic about the vaccine, we know, especially overseas, well, even in our country, but overseas as well, the deployment of that vaccine will not be a smooth experience. And so that alone, the vaccine, the variants, and the distribution of them will create more volatility in the year to come. Stimulus and speculation around that, and Matt spoke to that. There's no question there's a speculative element in all of these markets around the world. There's going to be speculation around the U.S. dollar, which has been weak. Some might argue it's currently oversold, but depending on what the U.S. Fed does on trying to contain the long end of the curve, and if it engages in yield curve control, could that put more pressure on the dollar? If the Chinese government tightens, could that, again, put more pressure on the dollar? We've got geopolitical uncertainty, some of which has been touched upon, but China-U.S. trade relations in particular. We also have domestic political instability. That's a new dynamic for all of us that we have to confront and contend with. And what might that do, not only to U.S. markets, but overseas markets? And so for all those reasons, I think volatility, which has receded here a bit in recent weeks and months, may resurface and will emphasize the need to be invested in our view. You want to have a healthy dose in very high-quality companies, dominant companies with very predictable, reliable cash flow streams, great balance sheets, attractively valued. There may be places in portfolios for more speculative high flyers. There may be places in portfolios for more cyclically exposed names. But in our view, you want to have the bulk of your exposure to those names that can continue to compound cash flows and grow and protect wealth as well as create wealth. And we see a continuation of some of the key themes that were accelerated in 2020, namely the digitalization of the consumer, the digital transformation of the enterprise, innovations in healthcare, all those themes that were accelerated in 2020. We think those are long-lived trends that will carry us not only in 2021 but beyond. So I think I'll pause there, Barry, and hand it back to you.
Well, that's great, Kishore. Thank you very much for that. And Craig, your thoughts about 2020 and 2021 positioning?
Yeah, well, I think the guys did a good job summarizing what happened in 2020. Obviously, a crazy year for everybody. but picking up on one of the things that Matt touched on, I think, you know, going back a year ago, the markets being relatively complacent, I think we're definitely not complacent now. I think we're in a place where you're starting to see investor sentiment get ahead of itself, I would say. If we look back a year from now and we look at the outlook for the global economy and we compare that to the outlook for the global economy in 2021, I think it's hard to argue that things have gotten better over the last year. I mean, at a minimum, much more uncertainty about how the next 12 months is going to develop. And yet we have all major market indices up substantially from where they were a year ago. That, to me, is a strange observation. So, you know, we're taking that in mind. And when we agree that momentum has really been one of the key themes for 2020, and particularly that accelerated in the fourth quarter of 2020, I think Doug was saying when I talked to him last week, that the Russell 2000 for the fourth quarter of 2020 had its best quarter ever. So that's clearly not a sign that investors are fearing anything. It's definitely a sign of investor optimism, and you're seeing it basically everywhere you look, you know, whether it's Tesla or, I'm not making a call on Tesla per se, but you do see signs of speculative excess around global markets. And so, you know, we're observing that, and we don't make any macro predictions, and we don't position the portfolio from a top-down standpoint, but to the extent that we do have areas of the market, or we own companies that are perceived to be beneficiaries of these accelerating trends, and these stocks are up multiple hundreds of percent, I think you're going to see us exiting those positions and probably just on a bottom-up basis allocating more capital to areas of the market that are not seen as sexy in the current investing climate. And somebody mentioned the UK earlier. It's been an area that's had this Brexit overhang now for a few years. It's one of the only markets that wasn't up in 2020. So I guess it's not surprising that that's where we have our largest exposure right now is in the UK. We think that there are interesting opportunities for great companies in the UK that are going to survive and thrive for many years into the future, regardless of what happens at Brexit. So, I guess I'll just leave it there and turn it back to you, Barry.
Okay. A question I'd like to ask is, I know since the middle of May, the EM index, the MSCI EM, is up about 53%, whereas the S&P is up 33%. So you're seeing about a 20 percentage point outperformance of EM relative to the S&P since May. And a lot of folks are talking about the fact that the U.S. has outperformed by so much for so long that the first real pain of having a home bias or an excessive allocation to the U.S. relative to global market cap is starting to show. How do you feel about home bias, and what is your comment to the FAs on this call about addressing home bias, the urgency to it, the importance of it, and how best to do it? I'll start with Kishore, and then I'll go to Craig, and then I'll go to Matt.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. Clearly an important topic, as the data indicates. We've had such a great run, and we manage global strategies, international strategies, domestic strategies, and so we don't have any particular favorite child per se, but the numbers are clear as you alluded to, and in particular, I think some of the factors that we like that are going to be tailwinds to the international side. Besides those performance data, and I alluded to before, is the state of the U.S. dollar and the enormous amount of stimulus that is being applied here in our home country on a fiscal basis and on a monetary basis, and likely based on recent comments from Chairman Powell and from President-elect Biden, we're going to see more of that on both dimensions. And that likely continues to pressure the dollar, which creates that tailwind abroad. And those foreign markets, look at places like Argentina and India in particular, that were particularly hard hit from a GDP perspective in 2020, that are poised to have recovery this year. Those create interesting opportunities, in our view. The trends I spoke about earlier, secular trends, long-term secular trends in the digitization of the consumer and the enterprise and innovations in healthcare. Those are not just U.S. or Silicon Valley trends. They're wonderful companies in all of these geographies. That also are poised to benefit from them as well. I think the speculative element that we've all touched upon, I think, is particularly salient as it pertains to U.S. markets, because we have evident signs of that, whether it's Robinhood trading data, option data, margin debt data. There's a lot of special purpose acquisition company issuances. There's a lot of reasons to be, careful and cautious, particularly about U.S. markets. So that combination of risk factors here, the U.S. dollar, great opportunities overseas, wonderful growth companies overseas, are all reasons to think about having diversification in the portfolios, and that can come in different ways. That can come in the form of global portfolios that allow a blend of U.S. exposure and international exposure, or international strategies, EM strategies that our firm and all of our peers here on the call also offer. I'll stop
Great.
There.
So you're not making a market timing call. You're not making a market timing call, but your observations are that global diversification is a sensible strategy, is what I'm hearing. Is that right?
Especially for anyone who's in it for the long haul and trying to preserve wealth first and compound it over the long term. That's absolutely the case.
Yeah. Craig, your thoughts on the home bias issue and how you think about it? And Cain also is another firm that has a big U.S. exposure, right? So it's not like that's the only thing you got.
Yeah, well, we are biased towards small caps. So, and I think that that's that's the one point that we've been making for some time. I mean, I think obviously there is a home bias when you look around the world. It's not just here in the U.S. People tend to overweight their home country. It's just systemic everywhere. But what we've been making the argument for some time for U.S. investors is that home bias probably exists to an even much greater degree within the small cap universe. So, you know, I think a lot of people have bought into global diversification. They've gotten exposure to developed markets. They've gotten exposure to emerging markets. But invariably, that exposure has been in these large mega cap companies for the most part. And the small cap part of the international emerging markets universe, I think, has been left out of most U.S. investors' portfolios. And we think that that is a mistake. Number one, you know, the size of the international small cap universe is so much bigger relative to the overall international universe. It's much bigger than small caps as far as their makeup in the U.S. market. So it's just a big market to ignore, number one. And the substantial outperformance of small caps versus large caps in international developed markets is pretty substantial. And so, you know, we think with one of our portfolios, which tend to be like Shore was mentioning earlier, it sounds like we invest in the same kinds of companies that have, you know, good competitive protections, good balance sheets, strong cash flows. You know, our portfolios tend to move up and down a little bit less than the benchmark. So if you can pick up better returns, lower volatility by diversifying some of your international exposure into small caps, you know, we think that that's a pretty easy call to make.
Okay, great. And also, Matt, from your perspective, you also are a global investor. Your thoughts on addressing home bias?
Yeah, look, Barry, I think it's been great. If you look back at 2020, you know, I think maybe some people on the call here today and you will certainly recall, you know, going back to the midpoint of 2020, I think there's been a lot of surprising things that happened in 2020. As Craig pointed out, in one simple one, if you would have ever imagined what would have happened in 2020 in general and see where markets ended up, that certainly would have been a surprise to most. But I think one non-surprising thing in 2020, honestly, and as I was mentioning, your callers out there, and you would remember, if you go back to the middle of this year, I think the emerging markets rally we had was the most unsurprising thing. You know, we talked about it mid-year last year. I think that was, and I think it still is, to your question too, one of the last freer lunches out there. Emerging markets were just so predictable in terms of the catch-up trade to come there yet. The capital is just sloshing around, and it just hadn't found its same way there yet. So I think there it was obvious, and I think the relative attractiveness of it still outside the U.S. is there. And you know, as Kishore mentioned too, you know, we're similar in that, you know, we really don't have a favorite child. We never pick different strategies, but you know, we'll call it as we think we see it, and that had been lagging behind, as I said, going back to the broader arc. If you have to go back to 2016 and those markets bottoming and what it took to climb out of there and what happened in between. So I think the value relatively is there. The catch-up is there. That's where the value is in, A. I think, two, you know, you look around the world, there's really only one country with real rates in the world, and that's China. Everybody else is in a negative real rate environment. So, you know, the capital is going to flow there, going back to this catch-up still yet. You still have economies like India and Indonesia, which are big economies with big populations that are have the upside to recovery here. And I'm not saying the U.S. also, we're not looking at it recovery, but at least if you look at the U.S. now, you know, we're going to have to peel back and see what the U.S. looks like with and an absent fiscal policy, which is necessary to bridge a gap, mind you. We'll see how actually pro-cyclical it is. A lot of it's an emergency mechanism. But these economies in the emerging markets, they've struggled all through this without the fiscal response we've had here, right, without a fraction of it. They've choked it down like medicine, and they're going to come out of it. And I think it goes back to, you know, the other thing we've been saying with you for years, the emerging are becoming more developed, and developed are coming more emerging. You know, as we saw, our capital ransacked like it's Turkey in the last couple of weeks, right? So, you know, I think a lot of things point ex the U.S. to the emerging markets in general. I think also, you know, some of the other markets were mentioned, you know, U.K. now a couple of times. You know, Europe in general is just cheaper. Obviously, there's a different constituency of businesses there, but if you can get quality, you can get better growth, and you can get attractive valuations there, and the broader market's just cheaper. And none of this outside the U.S., I think it all comes back to the question that's been answered a couple times around the dollar, too, still. You know, the dollar has gone through a weak period yet, but as I said, if you look at the interest rate backdrop and at least the near-term trajectory, you know, that still seems to be a bit of a free lunch there as well, at least. So, you know, stick with quality. Clearly, I think all three of us on the line echo that in terms of our investment philosophies. But for an investor here in this market, you're right, Barry, and you and Burgess have been right to push this. You know, I think you need to get away from the home bias for your own protection longer term as one personal piece of advice. Some diversification outside of this market matters, and it doesn't have to be Bitcoin to run for your safety, as I chuckle, because I think that's a little bit ironic to look for safety. These other markets are tremendous with great companies, a great upside, sometimes lower hanging fruit, as I've elaborated on as well.
Yeah. Okay, great. What I'd like to do is I'm going to ask Kishore one question on a sector-based question, and then I'm going to ask the operator to open it up to the field for questions. So before we go to the operator, Kishore, digital payments is a big topic, and a lot of people are expecting it to accelerate in a post-COVID world. How will developed markets and emerging market companies adapt to these digital payment themes, in your view, want to go forward?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, because that is an important theme throughout our portfolios, whether we're talking about our domestic portfolios or international or global portfolios. And, you know, there's a, you know, we all know about PayPal here in the United States, but there's the certainly the equivalents around the world, whether you're talking about Mercado Libre and its Mercado Pagos financial technology and payment business in Latin America growing its transaction volumes in triple digits, 100% growth, and it really accelerated their user acquisition. And Mercado Libre and Mercado Pagos unit, you know, really about financial inclusion and bringing in millions, hundreds of millions of people into the modern financial system. And many of these people are underbanked or completely unbanked. And we see the same thing going on in other places like in India, where it's not a digital native company, but a company like HDFC Bank, which is a traditional bank, but a for-profit private sector bank. It's growing its deposits in the high teens rates. They have, you know, 14 million credit card users. That makes them the market leader with 14 million, which is, you know, a quarter of what Citibank or American Express has in this country. But India, of course, has, you know, four times the population. So you can just imagine that growth is just, you know, years and years ahead of double-digit growth there. Kakao in South Korea, which is a super app there with, you know, 90% of the population having the Kakao super app on their phone, and their payments business growing at 60% rates and allowing that company to sustain, you know, well into 20-30% growth overall. And we can go on. There's many, many of these examples throughout the world, and as a way to participate in the rise of the middle class, and in many cases, these digital innovators are enabling the rise of the middle class and bringing in the unbanked into the modern era. So look forward to talking more about them if that's of interest. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. All right, what I'd like to do, operator, is open it up for questions, please.
Certainly, and thank you. Mr. Mandinac, there are no questions at present time.
Okay, you know, I'll ask a question to get something going. Hopefully, maybe some folks will call in the interim. But, you know, I think it was you, Kishore, that made the comment about smoother ride access to the non-U.S. equity markets and how important that is. And, you know, 2020 did teach us all that the best investment is the one you can stick with through thick and thin. So, you know, you got to be able to play through with your investments, if you will. So I'm going to ask each of you, because each of you have long-term, multiple market cycle records of risk-adjusted excellence, what is the key to your ability to deliver smoother ride access to these markets? I'll start with you, Kishore, then I'll go to Matt, and then to Craig.
Yeah, I think it's really twofold in our case. One, it begins with quality, and that's an often used and perhaps can be rendered a meaningless word because it is so commonly used. But to us, it's really about finding dominant companies, first and foremost, whose market position can be counted on and relied upon, and they benefit from scale. And we tend to play typically in large cap companies as a result of that search for quality and dominant positions, companies who have created oligopolies and have, you know, very benign competitive dynamics and healthy pricing and healthy returns. And another part of the quality that we care about is the predictability and the linearity of the revenues and the cash flows. So we tend to avoid highly cyclical companies because they're just not predictable enough. And there's a lot of investor error and manager error involved with cyclicals, people buying the tops and selling the bottoms. And one way to avoid that risk is to not get involved with that that kind of risky company. So we want companies that can deliver the goods, revenues, earnings, cash flows, all those great fundamental qualities in good times and bad times. So we're looking for all-weather companies. So and then the ability to keep that growth going. So that's how we define quality. And then we couple that, very importantly, with a cash flow-based valuation discipline. And so we, once we have identified those great companies, we will not just pay any price and ride them indefinitely. We want to make sure that there's a visible, tangible, quantifiable return case on owning those shares. And so when you couple that together, that quality and that valuation discipline, with that that manifests itself really in difficult times. That's when we think strategies are really tested, and having that superior downside capture and mitigating the downside pressure is how we achieve superior compounding over time. Rather than getting greedy when others are greedy, we protect on the downside and then participate in the upside.
So that's great. Thank you for that. And Matt, when I look at the Von Tobel portfolios, there's a common thread, like there is with SGA and Kane, where you see over multiple market cycles very significant rankings in things like Sortino ratio and Sharpe ratio and downside capture relative to peers and benchmarks. How do you make the ride smoother? How do you seek to make the ride smoother in your portfolios?
Yeah, I think, Barry, not to, you know, duplicate what Kishore said, you know, I would echo everything he said, you know, certainly on the company side, but, you know, maybe just to add something else, you know, on top of the business side, predictability being obviously something we really greatly cherish. I think from a portfolio construction standpoint, that's something also that the end investor needs, and something that's part of our philosophy on portfolio construction that helps smoothen the ride, in that, you know, we have certain buckets of companies in the portfolio. We certainly have the companies that, you know, we would sort of more or less define them as the leaders, who are out there growing very cleanly, very purely at a very rapid pace, and heavily reinvesting into their businesses at high incremental rates of return, and just is just growing fast. But, you know, we don't have a portfolio only of those. We have a layer of the portfolio next to that, that are more of the defenders, as we would call them, you know, that are very predictable, but, you know, maybe aren't the fastest growth and maybe are a little bit more boring, but equally have great economics. And they're offensive, don't get me wrong, but we drag around a few of them from time to time through the market cycle as an insurance policy, because, you know, the market isn't always very narrow, and the market isn't always defining all success in one area. Or flavor, and momentum clearly can cluster a little bit more around the leaders at certain points in time. And so we make sure we got defenders laced next to them. And then we have other companies that are sort of in between, that are growing headily, but they don't have a lot of area for reinvestment in their business, so they're kicking out a lot of cash at the same point in time. So I think portfolio construction, on top of, you know, just the focus on what we buy, is important. And look, it adds at a drag and an enhancement at certain parts of the cycle too, back to, you know, downside and down markets, upside and up markets. But, you know, a cautious, measured approach on top of the portfolio construction and into areas like China and the emerging markets, right? You know, we have very effective stock picking in China, in Chinese companies, but we have a very measured approach to what we're willing to buy there, which leaves us structurally underweight. steadily increasing, but structurally underweight because we're more careful and measured. So I think, you know, all those ways, being careful, measured, you know, measure three times, cut once, as a carpenter would, in your approach, making sure you cross all your bases, layering in portfolio construction on top of what you're willing to buy. I think those are a lot of the ways you try to smoothen the ride.
All right, thank you. And Craig, would you have anything to add in terms of the key to your risk-adjusted output over time?
No, I would agree with what the other guy said. Maybe one thing to add there would be just a willingness to be different. I think overall different in terms of how we're thinking about investments, not necessarily riding what is hot at the moment, but also being maybe just as important, being willing to look different than the benchmark. So, you know, for our international small cap portfolio, Japan has become, you know, 23-24% of the portfolio. We're not going to invest our clients' capital at a rate of 20-25% into Japan just because that's what MSCI has determined the weight is in the benchmark. And I think most of our peers tend to follow within a pretty close range of the benchmark when it comes to sectors and when it comes to geographies. And I think we feel like we're able to make decisions about where capital should be invested independent of what MSCI says. And so that can cause us to look a little bit different than the benchmark at times. And I think that has served us well over time as well.
Okay, that's good. Thank you. Operator, any questions pop up since we first inquired?
Yes, sir. We do have one question. It comes from Victor. Your line is...
Hey, guys. Hi. Victor Tan in San Francisco. Thank you for taking the time out today. A couple of questions in my mind, and thank you for, you know, so far you have provided us. In terms of your own strategies, how have you done in Q4 and then for the year 2020? And then the other part of the question would be, given where we are, you know, a tremendous rebound in the market, Q4 seemed to have brought a lot of the reopening America type of investment ideas into, you know, pretty strong performance. How do you read into the market today, especially with the yield scenario that we have been kind of, you know, working through the last several days, fear of yields getting a little bit too early to rise? How do you interpret that? And would that be something you really start looking a little bit closer on the radar in terms of risk in the market?
Well, Craig, why don't you lead off with that one and we'll go around the horn.
Well, a few questions in there. As far as performance for the fourth quarter and for the year, we outperformed the benchmark. So actually, the portfolio is performing pretty well, and we're lucky enough to have outperformed in the first quarter and outperformed in the fourth quarter. So that's just sometimes luck of circumstances. We had a few really, really strong performing stocks in the fourth quarter that helped us keep pace despite the fact that the market went up quite a bit. Normally, with the types of companies that we're invested in, we would expect to underperform in a quarter like we had in the fourth quarter. But like I said, it was an anomaly in that sense that we had quite a few surprisingly strong performers as far as it relates to last year. As it relates to the market performing well, what's our outlook for this year? I mean, I think I alluded to it earlier. I would be pretty cautious as far as markets go looking forward. I mean, we, like I said earlier, We're significantly above where we were last year, and I would say the outlook for the global economy is probably worse. I mean, it's definitely worse than it was last year, and we just don't it's definitely highly uncertain how this is going to unfold. At the same time, as people have talked about, you know, we're not trying to time markets. If we are invested in great companies, we are going to have a return to more normal economic activity, whether that's 6 months or 9 months from now or 12 months from now. It's not really relevant. You know, if you're going to own a business for 5 or 10 years, that's not really an important part of your investment consideration. So, you know, luckily, we don't have to make predictions like that. We just have to go out every day and look at a large universe of thousands of companies and hopefully find a handful of great businesses that we think, you know, are not being fully appreciated by the market and invest them and hold them for the long term. And and all these things will hopefully take care of themselves. As far as yields go, you know, I think there's been a lot of, going back to 2000, I think, you know, people have been predicting higher rates, and every time rates spike up a little bit, then everybody either, you know, rushes to own the banks or panics because interest rates are going up, and I think a lot of it is just noise, and we'll see. I mean, I think that is, frankly, one risk to the market is if we do see inflation start to pick up and we do see interest rates pick up, Fed's hand will be forced and other central banks' hand will be forced, and I don't think that's something that's on anybody's radar right now, so that would certainly be, I think, a shock to the market.
Okay.
Barry, you want me to run? Go for it here,
yeah,
just real quick. Yeah. Look, I mean, the fourth quarter, it was another flurry of an end to the year. You know, for 2020, we outperformed in international, global, European equities. We underperformed a little bit in emerging markets. Emerging markets had a strong Q4, though. We were up about 18%, I think, in Q4 alone. So we gave our relative performance back in that rotation a bit in Q4. But, you know, honestly, in Q4, I was pretty happy with how we fared with some of the rotation that happened in November. I think we did a bit better than a lot of the real growthy crowd. So I feel good about that. I think, you know, Craig made some very important points earlier, and I think in terms of generally looking forward, I think you do want to feel a little bit and look a little bit different in a way, and whether that's in terms of benchmark positioning or agnosticism or, you know, what buckets of names you own in the portfolio. You know, looking different than the crowd and behaving different from the crowd, even from a performance standpoint, is sometimes actually very important, and it can be deliberate because it's what's setting you up for a better future or a better future environment. So I think that is an important part of how you look back at 2020. Very strong, heady absolute returns, good solid relative returns in a lot of places. But, you know, into 2021, I think there's a potential, obviously, you know, there, as I said, in certain pockets and geographies, and certainly within certain of the right equities and stocks, there's a lot of prospect for return. You never want to make a call on markets, you know, at all top down. You know, I could sit here and say Europe's cheaper, and it could be the worst performing market in the coming year. You know, all I'll say, too, is, you know, Europe, for the basket case it is, you know, that product itself, you know, or that fund, we have a small one, we manage Revertis, that was up 15% for a continent that's in disarray, you know, with enough of the headwinds and negative interest rates there. So you can't predict the top down. You got to get the companies right bottom up, as it's been echoed here. But I do think, you know, the yield environment is important. I think that backup, I think, was a bit of a wake-up, but then you get a quick retracement already. I think what people need to get their heads around in general, and I think this is where valuation is very important. You know, having any valuation discipline for the last decade has been a counterproductive exercise in investing, quite frankly. You know, actually, the more simplistic or rudimentary or dumb or obtuse you were in terms of valuation, the better you did. You just close your eyes with two hands, grab it, and hold on. That's been the right basic approach for the highest returns. But it also brings with it, you know, you'll get along for the ride in terms of momentum, and you leave yourself vulnerable to a catastrophic ending. And I think as you look forward, I think people are going to have to get their heads around the fact that, yeah, we can get a recovered economy. Yeah, we can get some fiscal action. But hasn't monetary policy been one of the most powerful backdrops over the last decade? And if you get a reversal there, and as you get some hints of that, I think that's where people need to be careful, and I think they need to be particularly careful around valuations of certain equities in particular.
No, that's great, Matt. I appreciate that. And Kishore, I'm going to ask you one question, and then we'll see if there are any more questions, or otherwise we'll wrap up. But the topic we've discussed, many FAs are sitting around in January noting that many clients sold out of equities in the depths of the decline in March, and in the subsequent rally, which was historic, up 60-70% from the March lows in many equity markets, you saw historic inflows into fixed income funds and ETFs and historic outflows from equities and ETFs that are in equities. And so you had a lot of people that said it was the best rally that many clients went to the sidelines for. So people are looking at this and trying to rebuild their risk allocations for long-term aspirations and objectives, and they're doing it after a 60 or 70% advance in the market when they've been in fixed income. And you think about the conversation between the low fee of a passive approach versus the active approach, and what are you paying for? How would you think about that, and what would be your points of guidance to an FA trying to rebuild risk positions in the aftermath of the 70% market event?
Yeah, that's a great and rich question, Barry, and rich in the sense there's so many important topics there. Specifically on the passive one, that's what I really like to focus on, because you certainly see it in the U.S. indices, and I know we're focusing primarily on international opportunities here today, but just if I could quickly just highlight it, the illustrative risks in the index strategy, because what's going on in the U.S. and this extreme concentration we've seen into particular large cap, well, not large cap, mega cap names, and some of them are, you know, extremely richly valued. I'm thinking of a electric vehicle company in particular, and I don't want to pick on that one company, but I think it speaks to the risks and passive strategies that if you just follow the benchmark benchmarks and the benchmark makers, you are subject to the vicissitudes of a kind of a thoughtless approach and just following the crowd quite literally. And as I alluded to earlier, there's so much data out there about some of the speculative excesses we're seeing, whether it's Robinhood, called option volume, margin debt, fractional shares, and a lot of this money that's speculative money that's flowing in are going into a small set of names. So the passive approach, I think, is more vulnerable to heartbreak and disappointment than ever. And like my peers on the call, we have a very much believe in a benchmark and different approach, a highly concentrated approach, finding 25 to 30 very high quality companies that are attractively valued, not thinking about the benchmark whatsoever, not playing the relative game, but thinking very much in terms of absolute wealth protection first and foremost, and then absolute wealth creation secondly. And there's so many wonderful opportunities to participate in that wealth creation overseas with the rise of the middle class, especially in emerging markets. But we all know there are incredible risks in the marketplace today. There's risks everywhere. There are unique risks in emerging markets. So having a disciplined approach and a thoughtful approach, and by thoughtful, I mean an active approach where there's affirmative decisions being made rather than blind ones, is absolutely crucial over the long haul to protecting the wealth first and avoiding those timing mistakes.
Now that's great, Kishore, and I appreciate that. And as we always say, for all the FAs on the call, we're not, arguing against passive per se. It's all about the degree of allocation, and it's not, active versus passive, but it really is a combination where you're looking for differentiated active managers, managers who have been through multiple market cycles and posted superior risk-adjusted returns over those market cycles, be it through Sharpe or Citino or downside capture. Those are managers that historically have been worth paying for, as opposed to just the average active manager, which many people use as a straw man. But that was very helpful, and I appreciate that, Kishore. Operator, before we close it out, are there any other questions from the field?
Yes, sir. We did get a couple of questions in. Next question is from Kevin. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Kevin. Thanks for your time today, guys. I heard somebody mention that interest rate increases might be just some noise, but with all the stimulus being put forth, could that cause some inflation, which would cause like the 10-year to go up to 1.3, 1.4? And if so, wouldn't that cause some of the market or some of the money to move out of the stock market into the more secure bonds?
Yeah. Barry, I'll just jump on for 30 seconds if you don't mind. Yeah, look, I think that is the most underappreciated risk if there is. I'm thankful, Barry, it is the first call I've been on in a while without any of your fixed income guys. So I feel a little bit more protected when I can say, because it's directly to your question. Look, I think the bond market should be more fearful of that particularly because I don't think the money automatically flows into the bond market to your question. I think it would be carnage in the bond market. if they get some kind of backup in rates to an extended magnitude, you know, the slow water torture from 1 to 1.25, 1.5 is the problem. But I think a more substantial backup in rate, I think, is going to be a real problem in the bond market. So you're right. Eventually, the money moves in when the yields get attractive enough. But once the movement starts, I think, you know, it could be dangerous. I'm not, to your question, though, you know, absolving the risk in the equity markets is where the earlier question was. I do think that's the big risk yet for all financial assets. So let's be clear, you know, we've had an incredible accommodative monetary policy backdrop. Everybody has to use math in this business. Math discounts future cash flows, and the higher the rate of growth and the further out you have to discount cash flows to get to your present value, the more at risk you are. So I do think a backup in rates, and you're right about what could be the variables that drive it, we'll have to see. You know, none of us has a crystal ball, but, you know, I think you are going to get fiscal policy action you've had in a long time. So that is something. It's different, right? You're going to get more action on the wage pressure side than you've had in a long time, if you believe what you've heard so far, right? And that's something you haven't had, really, in a meaningful way in a long time. So I think you're right about the catalysts. I don't know. I have no more predictability than anybody if it plays out, but I think you're right. The catalyst should draw some attention, and the fact that the move in yields could be dangerous to draw some attention. So I think equity still, I feel better than in bonds, A. I think you need to be in the right place in equities too, though, and that's where I think valuation is very important, critically. But I think your point about bonds too, you know, I think bonds clearly don't have the safety they used to at this point. I can't tell you what attractive yield that comes back in, but I can tell you, I think, from market action and behavior, once the move happens, I don't know if you'll find a lot of people jumping in early to stabilize if the move has momentum. So I would just be careful, because it will be a surprise.
Can I ask a follow-up
to everybody?
Okay. Can I ask another follow-up question? You know, with things going on like with in China with, say, like Alibaba and things like that, you know, we're talking about emerging markets and you know, international investing and stuff. Are companies is there some concern with some of these companies like Alibaba and everything that's going on with China and all that? I mean, there seems to be a real concern about those type of companies.
Barry, if it's right on it, I'll do 30 seconds. Sorry to hog it, and then these guys can jump in. But look, I think there's two points. One, honestly, if you read about what's going on at Alibaba in China, it's funny, and this goes back to my comment, the emerging are getting a little more developed and developed are getting a little more emerging. You know, the Chinese regulator is acting a bit proactively on the tech side, you know, where everybody in this country is sort of yelling in hindsight, or at least politicians are, of what should have, could have, would have been done or what they want to do once the egg, you know, sort of the cake has already been baked. So, you know, the Chinese regulator is making a lot of noise, but honestly, and I'd have to spend an hour on this explaining it, what they've been doing has actually already largely, a lot of it, been on the books. They're just enforcing it more now, and they're doing what they traditionally do in a proactive way, you know, to control the market there. So that is worrying in the near term, but I don't think any bit surprising or concerning over the medium to long term right now. But I think the point you raise is important for that company or any company out there right now, and it's why actually we have a bit smaller position sizes, even at our most concentrated sizes, and I think that's what people should think about too going forward. I think there's a lot more risk in this market for individual companies who seem to be really great, also for exogenous shocks like that. You know, I think we're just in that part of the world right now where I would have to concede even the most predictable companies, given the moving parts right now, there can be some unpredictable actions that happen from left field too you want to be careful of, to your question.
Because in Alibaba's sense, they got some really strong fundamentals, a lot of good things, but boy, just something like China doing that and cutting them off could be and has been. I mean, it rocked. But anyway, I just was more interested in not only Alibaba, but other companies in the China region being harnessed by that, you know, and being hurt by it.
Yeah, look, I think it's a part of the game in emerging markets that's been there, and you have to watch out for it. But honestly, I think you need to look out for that all over, too. I don't think that's just an emerging markets problem. I think you could see some of that action elsewhere as well. Look, Europe is ahead of the U.S. in terms of what it wants to do from a regulatory standpoint. So I think you're absolutely right on the point, but I just wouldn't characterize it as just an emerging markets problem.
Okay.
Kishore, Craig, did you get to that?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Kishore, Craig, did you have anything to add to that response?
Go ahead.
I wasn't going to add anything, so go ahead.
Okay. Kishore?
Yeah, I was just saying, I agree with a lot of what was said. There, no doubt there are these types of risks, but they are global in nature, regulatory risks in particular. They do seem to come faster and more suddenly, obviously, in a country like China where there's a single-party ruling system. So that is not a surprise in some sense of the word. And in our view, if you look back over time, especially in China with these larger companies, there is this periodic risk slapping and controls placed on these companies. But what quite often happens in China and other places, the law of unintended consequences occurs, which is the more regulation there is, the more compliance costs the industry faces, and it often tends to result in a further concentration of the market power and the industry structure benefiting these large companies. We saw it a couple years ago in online video gaming in China. A couple years ago, we also saw something in the online education space in China as well. And in all these cases, the incumbents, the market leader stock, fell down quite a bit, referring to whether it's Tencent or New Oriental Education. And those turned out to be quite attractive buying opportunities. So it is somewhat par for the course in emerging markets, especially China. But as was said, regulatory risk is everywhere. The way we manage that is through position sizing and then being a contrarian. And when others are being fearful, that's when we try to step in when the valuation is really attractive. So I would just say that not completely eliminate the risk, but manage the risk, seeing that there's huge rewards on the other side of that as well.
Okay. I think we're going to have to wrap it up. If there are any other questions from the field, we'll take those separately. But I want to thank everybody for joining us and taking the time out of your day. If you want to visit our website at virtus.com, you can get more market commentary and portfolio-specific insights. Please feel free to join us on February 11th at 4:15, that's 4:15 Eastern Time, for a capital markets update with Joe Terranova. If you have any additional questions or would like further information, please don't hesitate to give us a call at 1-800-243-4361. That's 1-800-243-4361. Matt, Kishore, and Craig, I want to thank you very much for your time today. And again, thank you all for joining us. Have a nice day.